Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And I'm Don, your political science philosopher.
I'm Rob, cognitive psychologist, and really freaking cold.
You know, Rob, I was listening to the news today about something that I took part on that might have been dealt with you, about how the body can feel speech. Have you read about that?
Oh, yeah, there was a story recently about that the skin actually feels audio sensations.
Exactly. Apparently, you know, when we speak, we give up a puff of air. I was participant in that experiment. They were there and they were saying it was for some air traffic controller thing or whatever. And you heard, you know, bob and put, and then there's these little puffs of air. And apparently that's one way you can recognize speech is physically on your face, which is really puzzling because very rarely do you sit close enough to someone to actually feel the vibrations on that.
Well, maybe that's why some people feel that there's a difference between speaking with someone live versus speaking with them over the phone or over the radio or wherever, you know, like that.
Cool.
Well, so do you guys know that what the 20th anniversary was this past few days, December 6th?
I believe something horrible happened in Montreal a couple of days ago.
That's right. It was the 20th anniversary of the École Polytechnique Massacre, which is the worst school shooting in Canadian history. December 6th, 1989, a man named Mark Lepine walked into the École Polytechnique Engineering School and shot 28 people before he killed himself. And what makes this particular shooting so tragic and important to Canadian history is because Lepine was specifically targeting women. Since then, this day has become a rallying cry for stopping violence against women and promoting equality for women, which is something that I think skepticism should really get behind. We've talked about other human rights violations across the planet where women are particularly victims of some very horrendous and cruel religiously motivated crimes.
It's a topic of much concern and perennial interest to skeptical activists, I think, the sort of idea of fighting against misogyny, wherever it may come from. Usually we find it comes from religion, but it can come from anyone with, you know, incredibly incorrect beliefs.
Really, yeah, because I mean that's where I think our slant on this particular issue really comes from is, I mean, a lot of people think that there are real differences between the sexes vis-a-vis, I mean, either they're more intelligent or they're more evil or they're some other grossly inappropriate thing. And, I mean, a lot of scientific research has shown that there are viable differences between women. In fact,
Although, having
looked at both of them, I can attest that I have noticed real differences between men and women.
Most of those differences are really good, too.
Physically, perhaps. Mentally, and speaking from classes I've had as cognitive psychologist, there are differences. For example, men being slightly better at spatial, women being slightly better at manual dexterity and things like that. But these are minor differences, and also the differences between, you know, mental ability, intelligence, zilch.
Exactly. And I think one of the reasons that Lepine had mentioned why he was attacking the women is because he was dropped from the program and women got in front of him and he thought this was a terrible affront. And again, I mean, a truly skeptical mind would be able to assess it in a rational way, you'd hope, and say, oh, well, that's the wrong way, and maybe he should have had his wrath at the administration, but
his own incompetence,
exactly.
Whatever, right? I mean,
and I'm not sure that this is the only story of intolerance that's been in the news lately.
Well, yeah, surprisingly, it turns out the Swiss are intolerant as well.
Swiss? What are they intolerant of?
White chocolate.
Yeah, maybe, but also minarets. And minarets are actually those tall religious towers found on mosques. I actually think they're kind of pretty looking, but some people don't. And it turns out the Swiss are some of those people. They have passed a referendum in which the people voted 57.5% in favor of the ban. So which that means is that from this point on, minarets will not be allowed to be built.
And I believe that the government actually opposed this ban. They didn't.
Yeah. This was done by the people, a referendum. The government specifically said, we do not agree with this. It's going to just be a whole pile of worms. But people made their voices heard, so
actually,
the government is going to follow through on it.
What the people behind this, is, from what if I remember correctly, is a couple of right-wing parties who are attempting to stir up controversy or whatever, or get a linchpin. And as we've seen, you know, maybe not so much locally, but definitely in the United States, if you can get people's hatred up, you can use that as a political weapon, which they're trying to do. Although I did hear that, this probably won't pass the Swiss Supreme Court. But it's not the first time. I think it was in Switzerland or Austria, too, where they had a political campaign where they had these white sheep and one black sheep, and it was something, keep Switzerland pure. And
yeah.
I
heard about that.
You know.
Well, actually, it's funny that the Daily Show did a really, really good scathing report on this, and they even interviewed the Swiss ambassador. But I mean, yeah, you're right, Don. Like, this is being motivated by some really far right political figures in Europe, and it's seen a a revival in recent years. A lot of sort of like the national parties and the liberation parties have been gaining support across Europe.
Why does it seem like all these parties are united by a sort of religious conservatism coupled with complete intolerance of outsiders?
You look at sort of what's going on in Europe right now. I mean, they're in an economic decline. Economic declines usually follow some sort of, xenophobia usually follows economic decline. And it's sort of right now in Europe, the sort of hated minority is a lot of Muslims are moving from Turkey and Middle East into Europe. And
sociologically, Europe is having growing pains, essentially. I mean, it's not something that we really can understand here in Canada, the United States, whatever, because although we may have a very warped version of it, we've always been a multicultural type society, even if that multiculturalism has always been skewed. But I mean, if you're British or you're German, you are British and German, and you have the idea that you've been here for thousands of years, and this is your territory. And if you start getting in a number of immigrants from different parts who are really different from you, then people get fear, and there are politicians and groups who are willing to use that fear for their own political gain. Although not all of this is spurred on by right-wing nuts. Capitalism, believe it or not, has its role in it. I was looking at the news the other day, and apparently Mattel has released Burka Barbie. I don't think that's the official name for it, but it's Barbie done up in a burka and multiple colors, not just in your standard traditional black. But apparently this has spurred on quite a lot of controversy.
It's a liberal conspiracy to curry favor with the Islamic jihadists in North America.
Well, that's the capitalist argument, is they want to sell more Barbies in places like Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Indonesia, and they want to be culturally sensitive.
At least, it's really kind of, I think, offensive to, if you're a feminist. I mean, Barbie is not exactly the favorite toy of the feminists, and now that they're going to be selling them in a country where women don't even have basic human rights is not exactly.
It's a double whammy. And actually, the amount of fear that I've been reading about, you know, this whole thing about how, you know, it's perpetuating the stereotype of women's subservience. I even heard one, and I'll warn audiences, they might be a little offended by this, that the next product by Mattel is going to be genital mutilation Barbie, just to respect certain cultural customs in Africa that apparently
there's no way. I mean, first of all, they don't have genitalia.
How would you know that, Rob?
Yeah,
it's a Barbie.
Are is this part of your research into finding a difference between men and women? And
I think we
really
should go to a commercial now.
Why don't we do take a commercial break? When we come back, we are going to have an interview with one of the executive directors of CFI Canada, Justin Trottier. So stay tuned for that.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Joining us now on Radio Free Thinker, we have our roving reporter, Elon.
Hello.
And we have with us our guest, Justin Trottier. He's the executive director of CFI Canada. Welcome, Justin.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And so you're one of the heads of CFI. Can you give us a quick definition? What is CFI?
Well, CFI stands for the Center for Inquiry, and it's a transnational educational organization which exists in many countries, was founded in the United States maybe 10 years ago or so, although it goes back about 30 years in other instantiations, including secular humanist and skeptical organizations that were headquartered at the Center for Inquiry for a few decades now. But in a nutshell, we're interested in promoting reason, science, secularism, and freedom of inquiry. That's kind of our motto. And we do that through educational programs, through conferences and debates and lectures and multimedia projects like podcasts, for example, television productions. We also have a very vibrant campus outreach program. So we have in Canada alone something like 30 to 35 campus free thought, skeptic, critical thinking, atheist student groups. And in fact, CFI was involved in helping to found the UBC Freethinkers at an event that we hosted a few years ago now. So we're glad to have a very national presence promoting free thought at campuses around Canada. We also do political advocacy, very interested in church-state separation issues, freedom of speech issues, defending the existence and the equality for non-believers, those sorts of things. And we provide, more than anything else, a sort of welcoming environment where people who are a little bit outside of the cognitive mainstream can sort of get together and feel a sense of comfort.
Yeah, so that's great. Like, definitely we should mention that Justin was a very big part in helping the UBC Freethinkers Club get formed. And without the UBC Freethinkers Club, we wouldn't have Radio Freethinker. So definitely Justin and CFI, we owe a lot of gratitude to. I was actually really, the reason I was thinking it would be great to interview Justin is CFI has been doing some really interesting things lately that have gotten some media attention. One of the big ones is the bus campaign with the, I guess, the atheist message on the buses. Can you tell us a bit about how that came about?
Oh, yeah, I'd be happy to. So the Atheist Bus Campaign, which is still ongoing both in Canada and around the world, is very much a global outreach campaign, probably the largest of its kind, which seeks to make the point that atheists are a lot more numerous around the world than people might think. So it started in the United Kingdom, and as many secular ideas often do. And the origin of it was due to a bus ad that was actually promoting Christianity, and which had some very negative things to say about the final destination of the souls of atheists, if you can imagine. And so this prompted a comedian by the name of Ariane Shireen in London to write an editorial where she suggested that if they could raise a bit of money, they could put atheist counter ads up in London buses. And she raised a lot more money than she thought she would. In fact, she got endorsement from the British Humanist Association and Richard Dawkins, among others, so that helped a lot. And it was very successful, and many other countries caught on. Canada was one of the first, after the UK, to decide that we would like to launch a bus campaign of our own. It's now in dozens of countries, including the US and Switzerland, Australia, Germany, etc. In Canada, it was very successful. I mean, we met a little bit of resistance. We had it in about four cities. We were in Toronto and Calgary and Ottawa. And the Ottawa story is kind of interesting. We might touch on that later. It was they originally said no, but then a city politician by the name of Alex Cullen championed the idea on our behalf to the city council, and it was actually overturned. So it was a very interesting story with a happy ending. And in Halifax, it was also originally not allowed, but that decision was then overturned, or rather voluntarily overturned, because a Supreme Court challenge had been mounted years ago that actually, as it coincidentally turned out, ruled on the whether or not controversial ads should be allowed on city transit. Had nothing to do with our ads, but unrelated controversial ads, and the Supreme Court found that, in fact, it was unconstitutional in Canada to ban controversial ads. And so the Halifax Transit Authority was forced to recant on their decision. So we're just kind of getting our act together, and we're going to be relaunching a campaign in Halifax. So it's not the end of the story, but it has been a very exciting year with the bus campaign.
Yeah, that's really neat how you won that before you even started trying.
Exactly.
So are all the ads on the buses, do they all say the same thing, or are there different ones?
Yes, they're all saying the UK slogan, which many countries have adopted as a show of international solidarity. So that's "There's probably no God, now relax and enjoy your life." However, there were two other bus campaigns, smaller campaigns than the Freethought Association of Canada, which sponsored the ones in Calgary, Ottawa, Toronto, and now Halifax. There was also a French version in Montreal, sponsored by the Humanist Association of Quebec, which I believe ran the same ad, but in French. And then there was a campaign, also quite a bit smaller, by the Humanist Association of Canada, which ran the slogan, "You can be good without God," just, I think, in a number of subway stations, not actually on subway cars, just posters in the stations in Toronto. So there was actually a few different messages in different places. So we were happy that the end result was a more thorough campaign than we could have done on our own.
And did you get lots of feedback, I'm guessing both positive and negative for something like this?
Well, we raised a lot of money. We raised about 50 grand, our campaign alone. I think the other two campaigns got maybe 10 to 15,000 each, something like that. So it was financially successful. It let us do quite a bit. And of course, the media attention was more important than the actual ads as far as getting people into having a discussion on these issues. And that's really what I think was positive about the campaign. There was a lot of media attention, but also a lot of interactive discussions outside of that. A lot of public events were staged, both by our group and by other groups, where we could interact with each other on these issues. So as a result of the bus campaign, for example, I was able to have meaningful dialogue in the press with the likes of the leader of the United Church of Canada. This is the guy who runs the largest Christian denomination in the nation. So that was kind of neat. And I had the opportunity to debate various high-ranking Muslim imams who had different views on it, like Syed Sahawardi, the very outspoken Calgary imam who launched the pro-God bus campaign in response. So, these were very fun and also I think quite meaningful and long-lasting. And there were a lot of responses, individual responses. Would say something like 3/4 were very supportive, 1/4 was some kind of hate mail, but even those were enlightening.
Yeah, well, I should say on a personal note, actually, at one point my father, who's kind of a spiritual guy, sent me an email saying, Elon, I'm really concerned about this bus campaign, and it led to like having a really great discussion. So, it definitely did make a difference, I think, to some people just being able to talk about it. So another really interesting initiative that just happened recently was International Blasphemy Day, which definitely, I think, needs some explanation as to why did CFI have the gall to tell everyone to blaspheme on a certain day?
Well, of course, we like doing events and campaigns where people have to come to us for explanation. That's kind of our little gimmick we do. Blasphemy Day, I mean, the whole point was it was a response to what was happening and still is happening around the world, where censorship and blasphemy laws are becoming the norm rather than the rule. And I guess the biggest one, the one that should put a lot of fear into people around the world, is the United Nations actually adopting a resolution through the so-called Human Rights Council, which is kind of oxymoronic, that basically from now on, the right to not be offended, the right to have your beliefs respected to the point where they can't be criticized because that criticism is seen as a violation of your human rights, that is actually has now passed the United Nations through the United Nations Human Rights Commission. And this, of course, comes right on the heels of another resolution which has redefined the role of what they call the Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression. So now this guy, whose job had until now been to protect free speech, to look for places in the world where free speech was under attack, is now going to do the opposite. He's now going to travel the world looking for places where free speech is used to attack religion, which is obviously the job, if anybody, not of this guy. That's kind of a conflict of interest. And so you see these councils for human rights being sort of hijacked for something that they were never originally set up to do. So that's a real concern. It should be a concern to everybody. That's why Blasphemy Day is International Blasphemy Day, because of things happening at the UN and in different nations around the world. So Canada does have a blasphemy law, though it doesn't really apply it very much. But what we do have is our own human rights commissions, much like the UN Human Rights Council, which does on occasion, on very frequent occasion, in fact, take to their pseudo courts people who are supposedly guilty of essentially mocking or satirizing religion. And we've seen this happen with the publishers of the Mohammed cartoons, for example. They were hauled before these kangaroo courts and forced to apologize or recant on their views. This is something that we feel is an infringement of our right to free speech. Now, in some cases, those cases were dropped. But still, the fact of the matter is that some of these publishers have been bankrupt by the very process of defending themselves.
Wow, that's pretty extreme. You were mentioning about sort of the national presence CFI has across Canada. Could you tell us a bit about CFI Vancouver?
Sure. And of course, with the bus campaign and Blasphemy Day, having a national presence and having CFI in so many cities was really quite an asset, because Blasphemy Day took place in not just in Toronto. There was maybe the most active one was actually at our Saskatoon affiliate groups, the Saskatoon Freethinkers, that did an unbaptism ceremony for people that wanted to be, or debaptism, I should say. So, for example, and outside of Toronto, Durham region, just east of Toronto, there was a Blasphemy Day. There was a lecture given, and in other places in Calgary as well. With the bus campaign, we had CFI spokespeople around Canada acting in a capacity where the press could go to basically any major city they could find an informed CFI spokesperson to act on behalf of the bus campaign. So it was really great having these national connections. In Vancouver, yes, we do have a thriving community. We don't have a physical home for it, but what we do is we have actually a lot of our events on the campuses at UBC and at SFU as well. And so that I think we've been in operation in Vancouver for about a year and a half. We've been doing lots of lectures, lots of critical thinking related activities. That's one of our big, our mandate in Vancouver is to deal with skepticism and critical thinking. And there's actually a number of very interesting events coming up. So yeah, we encourage anybody listening in the Vancouver, greater Vancouver area to contact us to get involved in our activities.
Excellent. And living in Vancouver, I've sort of noticed there's definitely different skeptical battlegrounds across the country. I'd say Vancouver is probably less to do with religion and more to do with alternative medicine. What are some of the tactics you guys have come up with to sort of deal with sort of the regionalized pseudosciences across the country?
Well, one of the things that I think CFI is strong on is using its volunteers effectively so that people who have specific regional issues can find national coordination and national resources to really make the most out of targeted campaigns. So for example, because Vancouver is a hotbed of, as you say, alternative medicine claims, not that other parts of Canada don't have that issue to deal with, but because it's more of a pressing matter in Vancouver, we've actually talked with our Vancouver CFI leaders and they'll be leading a campaign to confront alternative medicine. However, we're going to be supplying them with national resources, professionals from across Canada to help them prepare their documentation and their other resources. And then we're going to feed that into our national network. So even though it's going to be run out of Vancouver, because CFI has this, for the first time, I would say, in the history of Canada, an effective national scope and sort of way of looking at the free thought movement, we can then use that material that's developed in Vancouver around the world. Around Canada, maybe even around the world, since CFI is actually international. So we're kind of looking forward to seeing how we can make use of all these local connections we have. Now, as far as the alternative medicine in particular goes, you know, so far we haven't been all that active, to be honest, on that front. We've done a lot of educational events, some very highly attended lectures and debates and panel discussions on such matters. We just had Michael Shermer, who's the editor of Skeptic Magazine. He came to give a talk in Toronto. We had about 500 people at that talk. It was broadcast to some of our CFI groups around Canada. So we had quite a large, virtual attendance, if you want to call it that. And he was talking about alternative medicine and other areas of skepticism. But it's going to be exciting to see if we can finally do some actual political advocacy to maybe change some laws or to get politicians thinking twice about the uncritical acceptance of alternative medicine and the way in which, you know, it's not always regulated so well as traditional or real forms of medicine.
Yeah, it's a very exciting movement. Like it's really going to be exciting to see what the cool things that CFI is going to do in the future to help promote skepticism and critical thinking and all the things that we, I guess, are all on the same boat for. So I guess maybe to conclude the interview, maybe you could tell our listeners if they're interested in supporting CFI, how can they go about doing that?
Yeah, sure. Well, wherever they are in Canada, in particular, listening to this, I guess the best way is to contact me directly, which you can reach me at info@CFICanada.ca, info@CFICanada.ca, and then I can sort of sort through that and pass you on to the appropriate community group, depending on where you're located. If you are in Vancouver, as I suppose the majority of your listeners are, as I said, there is a very thriving Center for Inquiry Vancouver, works closely with the UBC Freethinkers and the SFU Freethinkers, so there's a lot going on. Contact me through that same email address, info@CFICanada.ca, and we'll put you in touch with the right people. And it's really encouraging to see the growth of the movement, to see basically it's happening both spontaneously, and also through our efforts in so many different areas. So wherever you are, there's a way that you can be involved in this.
And is there any way, let's say if someone wants to financially support CFI, is there some sort of donation program available?
Well, now I'm glad you asked. Yes, the CFI just recently became a charitable organization. We have an educational charity designation, which means that all memberships and donations over $60 gets a tax-exempt receipt for your tax returns. So yes, there's definitely programs for donations. In fact, that is the way that we exist, is through our membership program and our donations. So, you know, if you are able to join us or you're able to support us financially, then you can see your money really be put to great use. I mean, we have a huge media presence. We're in the press popularly defending skepticism and humanism. So by supporting us, you're in a sense getting your views aired in a way that they really never have been up until this time.
Well, thank you, Justin. That was fantastic for you to stop by and talk with us. And I hope maybe we can do it again in the future.
My pleasure.
Bye, Justin.
Bye now. Take care.
Want to know what's going on around town? LiveMusicVancouver.com is the Lower Mainland's comprehensive source for live music listings. We've got more than 350 shows listed at any time, and our listings are updated continuously by hundreds of the very people who put on the shows you love. Artist information and MP3s are accessible right from the listings, as are maps and calendars for virtually every venue in the city. All this and tons more totally free at LiveMusicVancouver.com.
And welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. So thanks, Justin, for that interview. It was really great. So
thanks to Elon as well.
Yes, Elon.
We forgot to mention him before the interview.
Yes. So what's new going on in the world of science?
So there's a couple of stories here about this first one is yet another example of science defying not common sense, but defying your expectations. It turns out that the salad bar may be a more dangerous place than we once thought, because some researchers at the Royal Botanical Gardens Kew assessed a number of plants and discovered that tomatoes, among other plants, are actually carnivorous. They
I knew that for a long time. You know how I knew that?
The attack because, of the killer tomatoes?
Well, yeah, actually, that's a good one. I was going to say, because if you ever go to a salad bar, they always have a sneeze guard. So, I mean, why do they have a guard if there wasn't something to be worried about?
But, yeah, they did a review and discovered that there are more carnivorous plants than previously estimated. It's not something that really people studied before.
When you say carnivorous plants, do you mean like, you know, in the middle of the night, a pod's going to come
out and chew
on my foot?
I'm not talking like Tui from Little Shop of Horrors.
Okay.
You know, they're not going to be telling you to murder any dentists and try to take over the world. They're plants like pitcher plants that sort of passively attract insects and then trap them and digest them. The way that the tomato plant does it, and also there's also tobacco, potatoes, a type of mustard plant, they basically trap the insects by, they have spines or little hairs on their stems and vines that attract the insects. When they touch them, they die and they sort of get trapped, fall to the ground by the plant's roots where they decay and feed it nutrition.
So it's not so much carnivorous in a sense, it's more like a self-fertilizing.
It's kind of a self-fertilizing mechanism via a trap for insects, the same way that pitcher plants do.
Hmm. Cool.
I noticed you're using a cell phone there, though, Rob. Isn't that dangerous?
That's actually quite a common misconception about cell phones. A lot of people say that cell phones produce radiation and it's going to cause brain tumors. There was one study a couple years ago that I remember reading that was talking about how you keep your cell phone in your pocket and all that radiation can't be good for your gonads and it's going to cause you to go sterile. That was disproven with a study. But this one, it was a huge, huge scale study in Scandinavia. Almost everyone in Scandinavia, according to this one article. It was a 30-year longitudinal study, and they basically tracked the incidence of brain tumors and use of cell phones and, you know, the link between them over a lot of people, very many different subgroups within the Danish population, and found absolutely no connection. They did find a small, steady increase in brain tumors, but it started in 1974, long before cell phones existed, and the sort of increased incidence of tumors would be linked also to the increase in diagnosis and better diagnosis and things like that. There is absolutely no evidence that the radiation from cell phones will actually cause brain tumors or anything like that.
74 was when Watergate happened, wasn't it? Maybe there's a connection there that...
conspiracy theory?
That cell phones and... Okay, well, that's a weird conspiracy then. Well, I mean, hopefully that'll put to rest this kind of belief that's been going on for a long time. I mean, and from what I can tell, kind of spurred on by very wishy-washy evidence. I mean, the big piece was like a YouTube video created by a,
It was Nokia.
Hands-free Bluetooth company.
Yeah, I think it was a big viral video advertising the power of the cell phone's transmitters, and they put them around a bag of popcorn, I believe, and it popped and something like that. And, of course, it was complete bullshit, but more people believe that it was, you know, such strong radiation.
Well, I mean, that probably has more impact than a study that took place over years. I mean, not that it's probably a fantastic piece of science, but that's not going to have the same impact as a bunch of cell phones popping popcorn.
Well, this is why popularizing science and making, you know, publishing the studies in a widely available, entertaining format might be a good idea.
I think it's a good idea, but we should give people credit for one thing. I mean, one of the things that we are obviously all present with is our society is becoming more and more complex, technology is becoming more and more complex, and quite frankly, I bet you have no idea exactly how your cell phone works. For you, it's a little black box, and you know, waves come out of it somehow, and waves come into it somehow, and there's some chips and some batteries.
No, give me a little credit here. I have a pretty good understanding of electronics and printed circuit boards.
Well, let's give you the credit for it, but a lot of people out there don't. And because they don't have this knowledge, and not so much through ignorance, but just because you can't know everything about everything, well, except your present person talking, but most people can't know everything about everything. And so, you know, they sit there and they say, well, I don't know how it works. Maybe it could be dangerous. How would I know? And I mean, I don't have a problem with people asking the questions. What really annoys me is when you get scientific evidence and people deny the evidence that shows. Like this is a great study, because I think it's valid to sit there and say, listen, I got this communication device. I put it next to my head all the day. Maybe it could be doing something to me. Someone does a study, says, no, it doesn't. I go, oh, okay, now I don't have to be worried about it.
Well said. And I guess if anyone out there would like to, you know, learn more about skepticism, why not come to Skeptics in the Pub tonight? It's at 7:30 at the Railway Club right here in Vancouver.
As we all know, there's nothing that promotes reason better than a good drink.
Exactly. It's the last one of the year, so come by and check it out. Anything else, guys?
Does anyone have any? I'm calling up my calendar.
The only thing I've really got is there's two little things. One, there's a Davis Suzuki Legacy Lecture. It's a fundraiser. It's being held December 10th at the Chan Center here at UBC. Now, granted, it's a fundraiser, so they want a bit of money. So $100, $75, $50 is what they're asking for. If you can't afford that, December 10th is Human Rights Day, and Amnesty International is trying to hold a write-a-thon where, you know, you write in to help promote rights and the victimization of criminals in that in other parts. You can check that out at www.writeathon.ca.
My calendar is not working right now, but there's a talk coming up next week or the week after at UBC, I believe, and it's all about your rights as an individual during the Olympics. There's a lot of talk about how. What right do you have to protest, where, how, what right security has to take away your camera or your liberties and things like that. There'll be a public information seminar at UBC sometime next week.
All right, well, we're out of time, so this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying goodnight.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying have a good afternoon and goo keep warm.
UBC Rec is everything that is recreation on campus. No matter how you play, UBC Rec is your resource for fun activities. This student program is operated by over 140 volunteers.